speeding bullet. More powerful than a locomotive. Able to leap tall buildings at a single bound. Look, up in the sky, it's a bird.
It's a plane.
It's
back to the bin.
Everybody, and welcome to Back to the Bins. I'm Paul Spataro, and it is my pleasure to once again have my friend Blake PT here with me. It's been a long time, Blake. Welcome.
It has been. Yeah. It's great to be back. Thank you for having me. Glad we were able to finally get our schedules to mesh so that I could do this. It's great to be here.
And it's funny, I keep thinking back to the last time you were on, and that was shortly after my trip to New Orleans. And if people don't remember, I just find that amusing because I had reached out to Blake before we went and I said, what are the good comic book stores around in New Orleans? And he told me a couple of them. And then on the Sunday before we left, my wife and I and our two friends that we were there with took a walk from the hotel and we went to one of the stores that Blake told us about. And I bought a few things and then we left. And then when I spoke to Blake like 3 days later, it turned out that about 15 minutes after we left, him and his wife came walking in. And if I only had known that, you know, the timing was going to work out that way, we would have been able to
go
face to face, which would have been nice.
That would have been great. But
it is one of my missions in life, unfortunately, you know, because I had somebody who I podcasted with regularly who passed away. But we had never met face to face, and it's since then it's become a mission in life that anybody who I consider to be a friend on here, when I go to a different place, I do like to try and get a face to face meeting with them. So, if we're back in New Orleans or if you're in New York, we'll work that out next time.
Absolutely, yeah.
So, just as far as you know, for the listening audience, how have you been, and what have you been doing for comic books lately?
Well, I'm still a regular reader. The thing that I've been doing lately, the thing that's been taking up my comic book time, I've actually been doing something on my blog. I've been doing I'm calling this the Year of Superman. It started back in December when the trailer dropped for the new movie, the first one dropped, and it hit me. I was having a bad couple of weeks. It was just one thing stacking up on top of another, just little things, car problems, that kind of stuff, and when that trailer came out, I just loved it. It made me feel like so much better watching that, feeling like, okay, this is what I've been hoping for. This is what I've been wanting to see. And it charged me up to the point. I was watching this. I'm a teacher. I was watching this on the smart board in my classroom during lunch. And by the time I got home, I decided that what I wanted to do, I was going to make 2025. I was going to make that my Year of Superman. So what I've been doing every single day, I've been trying to read or watch something Superman related, and I've been blogging about it and been posting the updates like every Wednesday, because January 1st was a Wednesday, so 7 days I hit the next update.
Oh, that's very cool. And because of that, it influenced our choices of books for today. We do when we have a movie coming out that excites us, we do what we call a SCORE episode, and it's, you know, like an acronym, but it's a messed up acronym which would probably make a teacher crazy because we don't really hit the letters the way the words are. We actually just did a SCORE episode on Superman, and we're doing another one because why not?
Why not?
It's a shameless obligatory coattail riding episode. So the episodes kind of don't line up, or the words don't line up right, but that's what we call a SCORE episode. So when you mentioned that you've been blogging about Superman, I picked a Superman book, and you picked one that kind of matches it in theme, which is kind of cool. And you know, we're going to hit on that. So it's kind of a second SCORE episode for Superman that we're getting in short order. As the guest on the show, I generally give the choice to you whether you'd like to do your book first or if I should do my book first. first?
Well, you know, I kind of picked mine because of what you picked. So why don't you go ahead and go first?
Okay.
But yeah, because I've got a massive list of things that I've been reading and I've been chipping it away. Sometimes I do like theme weeks, like I did a Lois Lane week, Crypto week, Supergirl week. One week I did like every race he ever did with the Flash. But some weeks it's just more random. It's like whatever I feel like at the moment. So when you told me what you had chosen, it's like, you know what, that gives me the perfect excuse to read this one. So let's go ahead and do yours first.
Okay, and I took the lazy way out today. I apologize for that. We've been trying to do really well on writing up our synopsises and being, you know, diligent workers for the show. But every once in a while, I get a little lazy and I just go onto the DC Wiki page and find their synopsis and steal it. So I did that again today. So I picked, which I had not read yet, Superman Wonder Woman number one, which was. Had a cover date of December of 2013, and it was actually published on October 9th of 2013, and it's part of the New 52 Superman, and the story is titled Power Couple. It's written by Charles Soule, penciled by Tony Daniels, inked by Matt Banning, colored by Tomu Morey, and lettered by Carlos Mangual. I think the cover's a little busy, to be honest with you. It shows Superman and Wonder Woman each kind of running off, ready for battle in two separate directions with a bunch of faces in the background that are all kind of blending into things. Again, a little busy for me, but it's still eye-catching just the same. The synopsis for the story is as follows. As a storm forms in the North Atlantic, Superman insists that he can handle deactivating the convection engine that seems to be causing it all. Wonder Woman doubts him, but he confidently promises that they will be done with time to have dinner in Oslo later. She leaves him to do it, speeding off to rescue a plane caught in the storm. As Superman dives underwater, he tries to feel as confidently as he projected himself, but when he lays eyes on the source of the storm, he realizes that the situation is much worse than he thought. Earlier, Clark had a meeting with Cat Grant at the Ace of Clubs to discuss finding stories for their joint venture as a journalistic website. Cat was concerned that recycling other people's stories was losing them traffic, and it was Clark's responsibility to find the big stories. If they didn't break something soon, their readership would fizzle, and there'd be no way to rebuild it. At the same time, in London, Diana was sparring with her friend Hesia, one of the few Amazons who survived Hera's attack on Themyscira, where the sisters were turned to stone. Neither Amazon is happy about it, particularly Diana, whose mother was among those transformed. Eventually, Hesia decided to yield, knowing well that the princess was a stronger fighter, and a younger one too, to boot. And a younger one to boot. After all, Diana might never age, as Hesia has given her divine parentage. As Clark excused himself from lunch with Kat and her recently arrived boyfriend, Aaron, Diana complained to Hesia that being unable to be open about her relationship with Superman had made her worry that he was ashamed of her. Hesia reminded that Clark had grown up learning to hide his true self to protect those he loves. Amazons, though, celebrate their uniqueness and power, which is why his behavior confused Diana so. She resolved then to try to show him how to open it up about it, perhaps even later that night. Now, as Wonder Woman attempts to rescue the crashing plane, she is dismayed when Superman rockets up out of the ocean, smashing through one of the plane's wings, apparently thrown by something, tearing open the fuselage and grabbing up the pilots in each hand. She watches as Superman recovers, explaining that something was waiting under the water, but he couldn't see what it was. As he takes the pilots from her, promising to get them to safety, he warns Diana not to go down into the sea until he returns. Unfortunately, once he is gone, an explosion unbalances her, and Wonder Woman falls from the sky into the water. Earlier that evening, Diana had been visited by Clark, who brought her a rare alien flower cut from one of the plants in his fortress. Slyly, she responded that all the wonderful things he keeps in the fortress, he might think to let people see them. Sighing, Clark stated that there are things in the fortress in his life that would be better left secrets. One of those secrets is their relationship, which he explained that he keeps a secret both because he must and because he wants to. After all, as heroes, Superman and Wonder Woman give the world everything. For the time being, at least, their relationship would remain theirs. Smirking, Diana admitted that she had gotten him a gift as well. Raising the sword, her brother Hephaestus, I'm sure I'm butchering that name, had given
Hephaestus. Hephaestus, yeah.
Hephaestus, thank you.
Hephaestus. Greek mythology was my thing even before I was a teacher.
Good for you. Clark misinterpreted her intentions, but she explained that she meant to train him. While Superman may be strong, he is not known for his ability to fight. Who better than the God of War to teach him? Meanwhile, at the offices of ClarkCatopolis.com, Kat ignored yet another pile of mail, leaving it and many other letters unopened. Now, a military ship, the KNM Nendador, prepares to make its second shot against Wonder Woman, believing her responsible for the destruction of the plane she had saved. They find, though, that their forward gun mount will not function because the Amazon is angrily tearing it to pieces, wondering why they would fire on her when she had tried to help. Suddenly, though, she's surprised by a sudden jolt on the ship's deck as Doomsday makes his landing there. Diana does not hesitate in her attack, remembering how her evening with Clark had been disrupted by news of the storm that brought her to this point. As Doomsday grips her around the neck, she worries that they were foolish to think they could handle it. And that story is to be continued in the next issue. Now, I'm going to come right out. I had never read this before. I had kind of been into the New 52, and my excitement fizzled as it went on. So I don't remember where this came out in that, in that release schedule.
Yeah. But I want to say it was about 2 years in. It was about 2 years in.
And which would make sense, because by that time I was kind of,
yeah,
ambivalent about the whole thing, which would explain why I've never read it. But picking it up now, I thought this was a pretty interesting story. I expect it to be kind of like a storyline that I'll read and be done, almost like the Superman Batman series was.
Mm-hmm.
But I am enticed to want to read the next issue, which is always a good thing. When I pick up a new series or a new story arc, and we're discussing it on the show, one of the first things I come to, or the first questions I ask, is do I want to continue reading in this continued story if it's not a one and done? And in this one, I found it interesting enough to want to see and explore. I'm kind of seeing this as almost an Elseworlds tale at this point.
The whole New 52 kind of is at this point.
That's true, because I think my excitement and then fizzling almost mirrors the overall view of the New 52, because I think that's what happened. I think they had an initial, burst of excitement where people were buying, and their sales had really risen. And then over the course of several months, that just kind of went back to whatever it was beforehand.
Yeah.
But I find it interesting, the concept of exploring a possible relationship between Superman and Wonder Woman. And I think in the New 52, if I remember correctly, I think they also explored the possibility of a Batman-Wonder Woman relationship.
And that's one that I think they flirted with several times over the years. I feel like that kind of started with the Justice League cartoon. Like, they did a couple of episodes that kind of hinted at that, and every so often people have tried to pull it into the comics. But it was Superman and Wonder Woman that was, like, canonical during the New 52. Though I'll tell you something that impressed me about this, because Superman is my favorite character. I have not missed an issue of a regular Superman book since like 1990. So I've always been right up in there. And one thing that I was impressed about this, not just this issue, but I remember the series as a whole, is that it did tie in very well with what was going on in the Superman books and in the Wonder Woman book. At the time, the whole thing with Clark Kent working with Cat Grant and all that other stuff, it's coming right from what was going on in those books. And a lot of the time, when you've got these team-up books, if it's characters that have their own titles, it's kind of like what you were saying with Batman Superman. It's like it exists in its own world. Like, it's not part of anything else. And this managed to avoid that pretty well. It really did draw in elements from both of their ongoing series. So if you were reading the Superman books, this went along with it. It belonged in there with the rest of those titles. It's just this happened to be, of the titles, the one that would have Wonder Woman in it every month. I imagine it was kind of the same from the Wonder Woman side as well. I was not reading her book at that point, but they're definitely bringing in elements from it.
Yeah, at the time that this was all coming out, though, or actually, again, just going back to the beginning of the New 52, the first couple of Superman and Action Comics issues intrigued me. But I think it was it Grant Morrison that was writing it at the time?
He had Action. George Perez actually was doing Superman.
But I didn't like what they were doing with his secret identity and all that stuff. And it really soured me on it very quickly.
Yeah, I agree. Absolutely. That's, and I always felt there was a lot of stuff in the New 52 that I did like. There was a lot of stuff, like you kind of said, that went stale after a while. But one thing that I never cared for, or in general, I never care for, is when I feel like a character is backtracking. You know, okay, well, we don't want him to be married anymore. We don't want him to have these relationships that he had before. We're going to make him younger again. And I always feel like they always say that they're trying to appeal to like a younger audience. That's something that I've never quite believed. You know, I mean, I believe that that's what they're trying to do. I just don't feel like this is the way to go about doing it. You know, because if you're taking away these elements, it almost feels like we can't think of a good way to tell a story with this couple. And then a few years later, you came back with, you know, Dan Jurgens did the Superman and Lois miniseries, and then Rebirth kind of recanonized the marriage and all that, and it all felt like this feels more authentic to me. Superman and Wonder Woman, it's an interesting idea, and I've liked it in stories like Kingdom Come. It worked very well, the relationship in Kingdom Come. Whenever they've tried to do it in the mainstream, like in the prime DC universe, it's always felt kind of perfunctory to me. It's like, okay, we've got the strongest male, we've got the strongest female, let's hook them up, without it necessarily feeling like it's an organic connection to the characters. This series, I will say, Sule did a pretty good job of having them together, of having them, they showed that little bit of the date where he's giving her the flower, she's giving him the sword. It's like, well, this is very much in character for both of them. It's like he's bringing her flowers, she's giving him a weapon. It fits. I get it. It's never been a relationship that I've really, really believed in this way. The Superman Wonder Woman relationship is important. I really think it is. But as a romantic couple, I've never been sold on it.
I think it's interesting to present it in the way they did here while they had the mm-hmm. chance with, you know, and I'm going to actually backtrack for a second off that just to comment on what you said. Yeah, I don't really care for the whole, we're going to pretend everything that happened already didn't happen, and we're going to start from square one, and we're going to retell you the stories we already told you in just a different way, because mm-hmm. we're so creatively bankrupt that we're not able to just kind of go forward with where we were. And that's what it feels like to me when they do it. And sometimes it leads to really good stories, but it still feels to me like it's a cheat to get there. Mm-hmm. So, I, you know, and it's every time they redo it. I mean, I thought redoing it once with Crisis was, you know, it was okay, and they did it in a spectacular fashion, so it didn't really bother me that much. But that also fell in a stretch where I really wasn't actively buying comics. Mm-hmm. So I left before it, and I came back after it.
Crisis actually came out just before I got into comics. I started reading around the time that John Byrne was on the Superman books. Right. So you know, I was aware of the Crisis, and I went back and read it later, and I really enjoyed it. It was another one of those things. I like the story. Crisis is a great story. It's an epic, you know, crossover, maybe probably the best one DC has ever done. At the same time, the thesis of it's too confusing, we need to get rid of all the multiverse, that was something I didn't understand then, and I don't understand it now. It's like, it's not that complicated an idea. And you look at media now, and there's multiverses everywhere. Nobody has any trouble understanding this concept anymore. It's just become another tool. It's like, what do you do with that tool? As long as you're telling good stories with it, there's no reason to throw the tool away.
Well, I think the reasoning was more along the lines of, we have now if we only count from the Silver Age, we have a 25-year history of these characters, and it's getting more difficult for our writers to, you know, keep everything in order and just kind of build on what was already there. So, you know what? We'll just sweep it clean. We'll get rid of the multiverse, and you can start telling stories as if this stuff had never happened. And as a continuity nerd, I find that disturbing because I don't like, you know, I kind of laugh at myself because I think about like the, you know, the comics in the Silver Age or before the Silver Age even, where they'd have like a cover with something, you know, Superman and Lois getting married or something along those lines. And it would say, not an imaginary story. and I would say to myself, well, aren't they all imaginary stories?
Right.
You know, so along those lines. But what they were saying, I mean, is that this is in continuity. It's not, you know, just a break from continuity. And because of that, it showed to me that they actually had an understanding that continuity was important to readers. And then just to sweep it all away, I find bothersome. And now, you know, we're talking years and years since then, too. So, you know, how much history, I understand where it's difficult, but sorry, that's your job.
Yeah, I get, and I do get, I hadn't thought about it that way, but keeping it more simple for the writers, that is an awful lot to keep up with. The great thing about the current environment, and there aren't a lot of great things about the current environment, but one of them is that the information is there. There are, like you said, continuity nerds who have entire websites, wikis devoted to this stuff. So if there's ever anything you're not sure about, if there's anything you're not clear on, it is not hard to find somebody or some resource that can help clarify things. It's all out there. I mean, if I was running any of these shared universes, the Marvel universe, the DC universe, if I was running, you know, the Star Trek TV shows, I would go out and I would find a couple of these uber geeks and I would have them on staff. You guys are the continuity police. You guys check everything we're working on and make sure it makes sense. You know, and you know that there are people out there who would salivate at the chance to have that task put before them.
Yeah, and you know, when it comes to certain things, there's, you know, I understand, like, on the show The Simpsons, which has been on now for, I don't even know, 30-whatever years.
30-something years, I think.
Yeah. I think they have somebody on staff, or more than one person possibly on staff, that when they come up with an idea or a joke or something, they're going to say, no, we already did that in season 17, episode whatever. And, you know, that's their job, is to make sure that they're not just regurgitating the same stuff over again, or that they're not contradicting what had been said before. And I don't see any reason why they, you know, these giant companies like Disney and Warner Brothers or whatever can't do the same thing with their.
They absolutely should. Yeah, absolutely. I 100% agree.
But if we accept the concept that, hey, they're going to go back and they're going to redo this because, you know, and I'm sure a lot of that is motivated by finances, that, you know, there is that bump in sales when they do it. So when they did it, and now you have a younger Superman, and not so much a younger Wonder Woman, but a less experienced in man's world Wonder Woman.
Right.
And you say, well, you know what, before we go too far with the Superman-Lois relationship, let's explore this a little bit. I'm kind of cool with that idea.
Yeah, and as a younger Superman, as a younger or less experienced Wonder Woman, I agree with you. It does make sense to me that this is something that the two of them would experiment with, for lack of a better word. Ultimately, it's something that I think they would kind of pull apart. It wouldn't exactly work. It's something that seems logical probably to both of them, but it doesn't have the legs of some of these other relationships. And I'll get into that when I get to my book, because it actually fits into my thesis on this relationship very well.
Yeah, well, that's where these two stories really complement each other very well. Were you actively picking this up and reading it when it came out?
I did, yeah. Like I said, I have every ongoing Superman book since the early 90s. I have read every one, and that includes this and the Superman Batman books and everything else. So, yeah, I was reading it as it came out.
And did this book, this series, come to some sort of satisfying conclusion as far as their relationship goes?
It lasted kind of until the end of the New 52. And you mentioned before about his identity becoming public and all that. There was that, and there was also, that went along with it, there was a period where his powers were reduced. His powers were greatly reduced. It was kind of like, you know, almost like a Golden Age Action Comics number one Superman down to that level. Where he was jumping really far, but he couldn't fly, and he could be hurt a little bit more. And that's kind of where it was at the New 52 era. And the Superman books, including this one, all kind of ended with this sort of crossover event in which that Superman, the New 52 Superman, actually died. And at that point, Rebirth had already been announced. So everybody knew, well, something's going on. A Rebirth had been announced. They had brought back the post-crisis Lois and Clark after Convergence. They were living on the New 52 Earth with Jonathan, with their son, kind of in hiding because there was this other Superman out there. And that kind of tied into it as well. And then Rebirth happened. And ultimately what happened in Rebirth, this is going to sound really weird. Ultimately what we discover is that through some sort of weird cosmic timey-wimey thing that I can't even detail because it's been a while since I read it, the New 52 Superman and the post-crisis John Byrne, Dan Jurgens era Superman were, as well as their respective Lois Lanes, had actually, they were the same people that had somehow kind of bifurcated, been split into two, and they wound up re-merging them and putting them back together early in the Rebirth era. So it was kind of this thing where Wonder Woman was sort of left out in the cold. Oh, my boyfriend just merged with his counterpart who is married to Lois Lane still. So it was weird in how they wrapped everything up. And then after that merging, ever since then, I guess technically that story is still canon, but it's like we're just not going to talk about that anymore. It's something that happened. It's in there somewhere. But we're going to pretend it's not. The dynamic between
I was just going to say, but it seems to go to the whole thing, like we're talking about, they're trying to simplify things and yet make them more complicated by doing it.
I think they were trying to get back to the Lois-Clark relationship, especially now since they had Jonathan as a new element, as a new dynamic. And that dynamic, I thought, was wonderful. Those early stories with John as a kid was just one of the best eras of Superman in a long time. They wanted to get back to that. They found perhaps the single most complicated way to do it. But they did eventually do it. And then once they did it, we're just going to sweep it all under the rug.
Right. Well, and that's... Yeah. It's a weird dynamic because, mm-hmm. you know, what we're talking about, you know, the old way of looking at it was that every time, you know, what is it? I think they thought every 4 years we have a new set of readers. You know,
that was like, I think that was the original. Yeah. That was the original mindset.
Yeah. If we did something 4 years ago, we could almost redo it now because it'll be different mm-hmm. readers and it doesn't matter. But yeah, that ended with the concept of actually collecting comics, which I guess mm-hmm. started to pick up some steam in the 70s, really. I don't think in the 60s, I don't think that concept had really hit home with the companies producing the comics.
Yeah, at some point it occurred to them that people were not just throwing these things away anymore. They were keeping them. They were reading them for years and years and years. I think it probably kind of coincided with that point, maybe in the late 60s, where new comic book creators came in who had grown up reading comics and who had kept them all these years and understood that this is something that people were going to do.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. You know, a couple of things about the story that just come to mind for me is, you know, it felt to me like they really just, you know, once they did the death and resurrection of Superman, they went back to Doomsday as a villain, a little too quickly. He should be somebody who, you know, I think back to, you know, the Silver Age of Marvel, the Silver and Bronze Age of Marvel, where Galactus was considered to be, you know, something special when you had an issue with him in there. And they didn't just have him pop up every, you know, every 6 months, like, you know, like you might say Doc Ock.
Yeah. Yeah, when Doomsday shows up, it should be one of those, you know, bring me my brown pants moments.
Yeah. And I mean, it's done for dramatic effect here, but mm-hmm. it's done for dramatic effect in a lot of books.
Yeah.
So that's...
It's like, if you just read... If this was the only story you read with Doomsday in the last 5 years, that would have been fine. But there had been so many, yeah.
Yeah, it loses some of its, you know, specialness.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, for that reason, I kind of... rolled my eyes slightly. But on the other hand, I thought it was done for good effect, the way, you know, the way he presents here.
Yeah.
So if I get rid of my notion of him being around too much, then it's kind of cool and it's threatening. And it's like, well, you know, issue number two, Superman, I'm sure, is going to rejoin her and they're going to have to face off against him. And it's going to be pretty cool to read. So
yeah, it's been a while since I read that one, but I'm sure that's exactly what happened.
Yeah. So story-wise, I thought this was good. I think I thought they did a good job of showing, you know, hey, their different perspective on things, which were both pretty reasonable. You know, that neither one of them seems like they're out of line with their perspective, but they are in direct contradiction to each other as far as how to handle their relationship and their relationship with each other and with the public at large. So I thought that was kind of a cool thing for them to explore in this issue, and I assume in this series.
Yeah, no, I agree. That was the high point of this series, is that sort of exploration and looking into it. I've always been, you know, Lois and Clark has always been endgame for me. So it was I always felt like I was marking time with this series, because it's like, you know, it's one of those things in comics. He's going to wind up with Lois eventually. You know, play with this other toy for a while. Okay, we'll see, but we know where this is heading. So. It certainly was not a knock against the series. I think it was just my brain and my realization of how comics work that made it feel like this. Ultimately, this is going to end, and we all kind of know how it's going to end.
Well, it's like when you see or read or watch a prequel, and you already know, okay, you know, this character has to survive. As threatening as this situation is, you know, he has to survive because he's still alive when this next movie comes out already.
Yeah.
You know, so it does take away some of the potential suspense or the feeling that these stakes are real. But just the same, again, I think this needed to be presented, and from this first issue, I think it may have been. From from the perspective of, let's explore the contradiction between their worlds, as opposed to let's explore whether or not we can have them be a viable couple in the long run. You know that eventually he's gonna have to go with Lois, but just the same, you know, I think it gives a good aspect to it for me that, one, again, it's showing the contrast in the worlds, but it's also giving Superman or Clark a serious relationship to have been in before he gets serious with Lois, so that he's not just this country bumpkin who's never been with a girl before pining after her.
Well, let's be fair. Lana's out there. I mean,
yeah, that's true too. But I, you know, I think, I don't know. I think this just matures him a little bit on a level that you don't see in a lot of the Silver Age.
So, oh yeah. You know, way beyond anything in the Silver Age.
Or even Bronze Age, for that matter.
Yeah.
So I like that. I like the fact that, you know, it's looking at certain things in a more adult way. And yeah. I always cringe when I say more adult or more mature, because it almost sounds like I'm talking about porn. But, you know,
you don't want to make that mistake.
I hate using that word, and I need to just say a more grown-up way. I think that's really the right words to use.
Or sophisticated, maybe.
Yes. So I like that, and it's giving a more of another dimension to the character, again, that he's been through this relationship.
And yeah.
You know, there's some realism to that. I also, you know, I sat and I was looking at the art closely. I'm not always crazy about newer styles of art, because I'm such a Bronze Age devotee.
Mm-hmm.
But I do find this to be very easily followed. The pictures they're not turning off. They don't have that real muddy look that a lot of the computerized stuff of this era has.
Yeah.
So I was pretty happy with the artwork in this book.
Yeah, I liked Tony Daniel in general. I love his run on Batman. He's done really, really good work on Batman. I think he did very good with this series too. And it's you can tell he's drawing a younger Clark. You know, if you compare this Clark Kent to, you know, even the John Byrne Clark, it's obvious that he's aiming for this. This looks like a guy who's in his young 20s, early 20s, which is obviously what they were going for at the time. So he nailed that very, very well.
Yeah, I find that a lot of artists can't, they can draw young children and they can draw mature adults, or, and they can draw old people. But that, like, between the ages of, say, 12 and 25, they're not so strong.
Yeah, they're all kind of the same.
Yeah. Or, you know, a lot of them, when they're drawing like a 17-year-old, all it looks like is a 30-year-old with a smaller body.
Yeah.
So you know, I do appreciate that this Clark looks to be 22, 23 years old. And
yeah, absolutely.
You don't always see that in these books, so that's kind of cool.
Yeah, but yeah, overall, I appreciate that.
Overall, I enjoyed the story. That's really, I guess, the bottom line on it. And I am intrigued to read more. So, yeah, I don't know if you recall the rating system for the show. We, as a teacher, it should fall right in your wheelhouse. We rate the cover, the artwork, the story, and then the book on a whole on an A to F scale.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, I like the artwork on the cover, and it is eye-catching, but I think it's just a little busier than I would like. So I'm going to give it a B. I think it's good, but it could be even better. Mm-hmm. The interior art, I like the interior art a lot. I'm going to say a B plus on the interior art. The story is easy to follow. The you know, it melds well with the words that we have here. There's points where you don't need the words at all because the story you're telling is fairly strong. And the images are pleasing to the eye. So I'm going to say a B plus on the artwork. The story, you know, it is your typical decompressed story, that it's a very quick read and there's not really a lot that occurs from beginning to end, although there is action. But it's good. And again, it made me want more. So I'm going to say a B on the story, and I'm going to give the book overall a B.
I think I'm pretty close to you on this. The cover, do you have the digital or the physical
digital
copy in front of you? Digital. There's a, like a gatefold. There's a bigger version of this. The image on the main cover is Superman and Wonder Woman and a couple of heads. But if you fold it out, the back cover and the gatefold, there's like, on his side, there's like all of the other Superman characters, and on her side, it's all the other Wonder Woman characters. And it's very, very busy. It's there's all kinds of stuff going on here. And the one strike I have against it is that the vast majority of the characters on this cover are not relevant to the story at all. It's like, okay, this is something like Lex Luthor's on there. Lex Luthor has nothing to do with this. And to me, I take a little bit off for that, because, you know, to me, if a cover is not indicative of the contents, it drives me crazy. I give a little bit of leeway if it's like the first issue of something, but at the same time, you should at least be hinting. So the artwork itself is fine. Conceptually, I have a little bit of problem, and I'll knock it down to about a B minus there. Interior art, I agree with you. I actually think I liked it a little bit more than you. I would give that an A. Story, it's that New 52 era. It's that period where, like I said, I do feel like they're kind of marking time. And while there might be interesting things to explore, it's stuff that it's the prequel problem. You know where we're going. So for that one, I feel like I can't really get much higher than like a C plus on that one. Overall, you put it all together, it's not terrible. It's not something I was upset reading even at the time. Probably a B. Yeah.
All right. Well, that's B isn't bad for New 52, yeah, as far as I'm concerned.
No, it's not.
So let's move on to your book, which I tell you dovetails so well from this.
Oh yeah, absolutely. When you said you wanted to do Superman Wonder Woman, I looked at my list. I said, well, this is the perfect time to read Action Comics number 600. This was came out for the 50th anniversary. It was their golden anniversary issue in May of 1988. I don't have the actual release date, but that's the cover date. Cover by John Byrne and like everybody else, hitting on all the different stories in it. In that classic sort of grid type of thing that they used to do in the Silver Age annuals, where you have the main figure in the middle and then the little boxes on the side showing all the different stories. And I love that cover design. I love that general look for what a cover is. And I appreciated that they use it here. There's a few different stories in this one, but kind of focus on the first one, which is the Superman Wonder Woman story. And this was the end of Byrne's run on Action Comics. This was his last issue before they switched over to Action Comics Weekly. And it also kind of wrapped up the period where Action Comics was the Superman team-up book. Ever since Man of Steel, every issue had been Superman and somebody else. And this start is Superman and Wonder Woman. And it written story and breakdowns by John Byrne, finished artwork by George Perez, John Costanza on letters, Tom Zico on colors. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that name right. I've never known exactly how that was pronounced. And it picks up right after the end of the previous issue. Superman had been kind of trying to find Wonder Woman because he wanted to talk to her, because they had encountered each other a while back during the Legends crossover that DC had done, which I believe was the debut of the post-crisis Wonder Woman. I think that's when she first appeared before Perez relaunched her title. And as this issue begins, Superman has found her and he is kissing her. And you look at that first page, they're kissing, and she's just got this look of utter shock on her face. Like, what is happening? What is going on? And after a moment, he kind of, they break apart, and he kind of apologizes for coming on so strong. I've been thinking about you ever since we met in Washington. I thought you kind of got the feeling that you were interested in me as well. He apologizing like a Kansas farm boy would when he realizes he may have gone too far. And she tells him, no, it's okay. I'm not going to lie and say I haven't been thinking about it. And they have this nice conversation about their respective lives and where they are. Because this is, you know, 2 years post-crisis. So this is a relatively young Superman. This is one of the first times he and Wonder Woman have encountered each other. He has not begun a relationship with Lois Lane yet. And sure, they're attracted to each other. That is 100% believable. I don't have any problem with that at all. So they decide that they're going to sort of go on a date, a quote unquote date. And they're flying. And then this date just really comprises flying around and talking until suddenly Wonder Woman gets an alert, a message from Hermes, the messenger of the gods, that he's in danger. So she rushes off through this portal to get to him. Superman insists on helping and he flies behind her. And he winds up in this weird M.C. Escher Kirby Crackle version of Mount Olympus where everything is topsy-turvy and he can't find Wonder Woman anywhere. His telescopic vision isn't working properly. You know, the gravity's pulling in every sort of direction. Wonder Woman, meanwhile, is also wandering around this place. They've been separated from one another, and she manages to find Hermes, who tells her that Olympus has been invaded by Darkseid. Darkseid is there. We see him and Desaad watching Superman and Wonder Woman wandering this twisted Olympus together. And then they each, Superman and Wonder Woman, seem to encounter each other, but it's not really them. It's Amazing Grace and Kalibak disguised as them, you know, glamour placed on them so that they look like they are who they're pretending to be, to sort of lure Superman and Wonder Woman into this trap here that Darkseid has set. They chase after them. They briefly are allowed to see their true forms before ducking out of view. And when they come back, they encounter each other, the real Superman, the real Wonder Woman, and they start to fight. They start to battle. And there's this great sequence here of 3 or 4 pages where Darkseid is just sort of watching them from a distance, watching on the monitors as they fight each other. And then this slow realization that they're coming towards him, that they are coming towards where he is hiding, and they break through. And that's where we find out that they realized right away, both of them, that the person that they were trying to be tricked, that Darkseid was trying to manipulate them into fighting each other. So wordlessly, without even having to discuss a plan, they both sort of manipulate this fight, this fake fight, to sort of bang their way around and find their way to where Darkseid is hiding. And they approach him, they reach him there. And that's when Wonder Woman drops the bomb that he has come here to assault Olympus. He has come here to take Mount Olympus, but Olympus is empty. The gods are gone. The gods are not there. And Darkseid kind of runs away with his tail between his legs. Well, that might be a bit too strong, tail between his legs. He departs, realizing that nothing that he is here for is worthwhile. Superman and Wonder Woman go back to Earth and have a little conversation where they sort of decide that, you know, their worlds are very, very different. And the idea of them being together maybe is not the best. They work better as friends, and then they part as friends. And that to me, that last page where they have that discussion is kind of part and parcel to my feelings on the Superman and Wonder Woman relationship. I 100% buy that they are attracted to each other. You know, that makes perfect sense. But as a couple, they kind of realize in the one issue here, what took many, many issues in the New 52 to occur to them, it's not quite right, because they have different worlds. They have different philosophies. Superman kind of says something along the lines of, you know, I knew that you were, you know, from the gods, but we were just at Olympus. You're like literally the gods. This is not something I was prepared for. This is, I know it's so strange to say this coming from Superman, but it's like, it's a little over his head. This is not something that he was anticipating getting involved in. And from here, if you go and read stories with the two of them that came after this in the years after, we saw this friendship forging between them. We saw this very deep and sincere friendship. And there have been many, many stories where I've heard where each of them has referred to the other as their best friend. And I think it started here. And that's kind of how I like these characters. That's kind of how I like the relationship. Because one thing Superman does not have without Wonder Woman is a peer, a confidant on his level. Somebody who understands the burden of this godlike power that he has. He has friends. You know, he's got Batman, he's got the other members of the Justice League, but who else is on his level? There's so few people on Superman's level in terms of power. Half of them are villains, and the other half are people who look up to him as a father figure, like Supergirl or Superboy. So having somebody like Wonder Woman who understands what it's like to be this, you know, to go back to the Justice League cartoon, the whole world of cardboard speech in the last episode, if anybody remembers that, who knows what that's like, somebody that he can talk to and confide in, I think is very important. And that's the dynamic that I like. These are these two people share something that really nobody else in the world that they can talk to understands or comprehends. And that's something that I love about their relationship. And this issue I've always liked, because I feel like it kind of sets the stage for that in future stories. And I really appreciate that.
I totally agree with everything you said. I wish there was something I could just say to say that you're wrong. But I agree with everything. It's just interesting how, and I think it's indicative of the Silver Age and then the Bronze Age, and I guess this would be the Modern Age, or if there's something in between Bronze and Modern, I don't even know anymore. But the current, between that, when this came out, and the current age, whatever the titles are, now it's gotten, you know, much more decompressed, and we've talked about that a lot in previous episodes. But this is kind of coming to a conclusion with their relationship over the course of whatever it is, 30 pages.
You know, yeah, something like that.
To at least resolve that end of it. You know, the story goes on a little bit. But they're doing it, you know, and they're doing it in a way where it makes sense. And moving forward and moving on. And like you said, it does create a foundation for a relationship, which is good, because they're not just sweeping it under the carpet. But then the series that we just looked at clearly wants to take that and, you know, review it over many issues and see where we can go with it. And I don't know that either one is the wrong approach. I think they both have their merits. So I'm kind of cool with both of them.
Yeah, you know, I can agree with that. This is my preferred approach, but I understand what you're saying. It's not really fair to say one is right or wrong. Yeah.
I feel like the decompressed storytelling, and as a writer, maybe you could even kind of have a more insight into it, but I feel like the decompressed story approach has merit when you have a strong message to send or when you have a complex mm-hmm. message to send. But sometimes they decide to just decompress for the sake of decompression.
Yeah.
And they want to have meaningless, boring conversation, which will seem realistic to the real world. So they think it's kind of clever because of that. But there is really nothing happening. And
yeah,
as a reader, that's disappointing when that happens.
It's they all want to write episodes of Seinfeld or Buffy the Vampire Slayer where they have these conversations that don't necessarily contribute to the plot. But Seinfeld was a show about nothing. It's okay there. Buffy, when they did it in Buffy, it was showing all of those conversations contributed to character, to showing who these characters were. When they do it today, when a poor writer does it, it's fluff. It's meaningless. It doesn't add to anything. My opinion, and I've had this question before about how long should a story be, and honestly, the only correct answer to this is the story should be however long it takes to tell the story, whether that's one issue, whether that's 12 issues. If the story fits it, that's how long it should be. And when we talk about good decompressed storytelling, the good stories that fall under this category are stories that lend themselves to be told over 6, 12, maybe more issues. But there are writers who have a story. It's like, well, I need to make this 6 issues because that's how many issues go into a trade paperback. And I've got to figure out a way to take this story that really may only be worth 2.5 issues and make it fit into 6. And I think it's very easy to tell when that has been done.
I think the case study for decompressed storytelling for me is if you read Brian Michael Bendis's Ultimate Spider-Man. Like, you know, the first 6 issues are retelling his origin from Amazing Fantasy 15, which was, I think, like 9 pages in its original
telling.
But I thought he did a good job. He fleshed out Uncle Ben. He fleshed out Peter's relationship with his fellow students. It took a while for things to develop. There was a slow burn going on. And I thought it was a sophisticated enough or complex enough story to give it more levels and give it time to breathe that it didn't have in its original telling. Not that mm-hmm. there was anything wrong with the original telling, but you know, it was elaborating on it and delving into it. But if you read other arcs of that series, there's issues where he just has people sitting around talking. And again, you know, I think you hit the perfect you know, example of it's similar to, like, you know, that he's trying to put together an episode of Seinfeld with people saying wise ass things. And it's demonstrated sometimes by the art where it'll have the same panel 15 times in a row with just word bubbles over it that are changing.
Yeah.
And I didn't appreciate when he did that.
Yeah. And that approach you're talking about with the panels, I sometimes see that done like as a joke. And if the joke lands, it's fine. But if they just keep doing it over and over again, it's very tedious. And I think Bendis is actually the perfect example of both the best and the worst of decompressed storytelling. Because you're right, those early issues of Ultimate Spider-Man, where they do take that origin and kind of spread it out and unravel it, those early issues are very good. You read some of those later arcs, they are not very good. I think the most egregious example, and it stuck with me for all of these years, I don't know if you remember House of M, the whole No More Mutants, right? Issue number 1 of House of M ends with Scarlet Witch saying, "No more mutants," and she casts a spell and the whole world is different. And issue 2, literally nothing happens in the entirety of issue 2. It's all these short vignettes where you look around and see, well, this is what Peter Parker's life is in this new universe, and this is what Bruce Banner's life is like, and all of these different characters. And I'm like, no, make this part of the story. Don't just give me these quick glimpses for an entire issue that move nothing forward. And that to me, when you see something like that, that is when it is at the most egregious. If I finish an issue, even if I finish a page and I don't feel like I've learned something new or something has moved in a certain direction, then that's a wasted page. And bad decompressed storytelling absolutely does that. John Byrne, who did that Superman run, you don't get that. The closest thing you could say is that wordless sequence in the middle of the issue where Wonder Woman and Superman are fighting in this empty Olympus. And you can make that argument that, well, it's just punches. It's not really doing anything. But if you go back and look at that, this is, it's very subtle, but you see that they are, in fact, we're kind of revealing through the fight that they're not fooled, that they are kind of steering towards Darkseid. And you can see on Darkseid's face as he's watching, he's laughing, he's grinning at what they're doing. And then he gets this look of concern when he realizes, oh, wait a minute, they're on to me. You know, it looks like it might be decompressed, but it's just a very subtle way of telling the story. And a good writer and a good artist, and Byrne is most definitely both, a good writer and artist can do that.
And it's interesting in this one, it's Byrne doing the breakdowns and then Perez doing the pencil and inking on top of that. And it's a very interesting combination, because two of my favorite artists that I lump them together very often as far as, you know, where I would rank them.
They're kind of that same school, that same style of, not to say that their styles are the same, but there's a lot of stuff that comes from sort of that era that they exemplify. They've got those clean lines, but they still have a lot of detail. They've got very expressive faces. I kind of put Kevin Maguire in that same category too. Mm.
So, but it's interesting to see them together. I don't recall off the top of my head ever seeing an issue that they collaborated on besides this one.
Off the top of my head, I can't think of anything. They both worked in for such a long time. You'd imagine there must be something else, but I can't think of it off the top of my head.
Yeah, I think, you know, the artwork, if you showed me this book and you didn't tell me who did it, there are several panels that I would look at and say, oh, that looks like Byrne to me.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say probably 85 to 90% of it, I would say, oh, that's George Perez.
What's funny is I've got it open to the last page of that story where it's just Superman and Wonder Woman talking. And it kind of like you're saying, if I looked at this page with no context, I would think that Byrne had drawn Superman and Perez had drawn Wonder Woman and they had just collaborated on the page, which they did, but not in that way, you know?
That's an interesting thought process. Yeah.
Because this looks like Byrne's Superman and this looks like Perez's Wonder Woman.
Yeah. I wouldn't be surprised if, as Perez developed the pages, you know, from the breakdowns, made a conscious effort to even keep that distinction between them.
It would be really interesting. Lord knows if this even exists anywhere, but to see the original breakdowns that Byrne did and compare him to the finished pages, I would be very curious to see just how much of himself Perez brought to the table with this.
Yeah, that would be interesting to see. I'm thinking most of the backgrounds are pure Perez.
Oh, I agree. Yeah.
And it's just the actual
Byrne doesn't. Yeah, because Byrne doesn't always do backgrounds that much. There are several panels throughout where it's got your classic Byrne floating head with no background. There are definitely some of those, but especially the scenes in Olympus with the rubble and the fire and the fighting, it's really detailed, and that really has that Perez shine to it.
Yeah, and then you hit it on the nose. I mean, I'm sure you and I aren't the only ones to think of this, but when you said, you know, he went there and to an M.C. Escher Olympus, you know, I'm sure that's the image they were trying to create for us.
Without a doubt, yeah.
Which was very cool as I was reading it. I always enjoy that. But
it's always fun when they can do that in a way that makes it logical, you know, for the story, so that they can play with that sort of thing and that sort of layout in such an unconventional way.
I enjoy it when you have an artist who can do exactly that. Every once in a while, you have an artist who tries it and is not quite up to the task, mm-hmm. and that's always disappointing. But here, it certainly lives up to it by every stretch that I see.
I want to say it reminds me. I think when I was young, when I read this the first time, it kind of jumped out at me and made me think of Labyrinth, the Jim Henson movie. At the end, where they've got that whole scene where Jennifer Connelly and I'm blanking. Who was the Goblin Prince? Bowie. It was David Bowie. Or wandering around in this very Escher-esque place, and it reminded me of that.
And that's a pretty cool image, actually, for it. As I read this, there were two things that struck me. One is how they quickly got to the relationship and took care of it and ended it in a very satisfying way with, you know, basically like one encounter. instead of having to draw it off. And then it's not going to. Go ahead.
So back to the decompressing thing. It's something else this whole year of Superman. I'm reading like Silver or Bronze Age stories and stuff like this, where I put it down. I was like, man, if they did this today, it'd be at least 6 issues long.
Oh, no question. Or it might be 30 issues. But it's well done enough here to be satisfying. The other thing that stood out, and you know, yesterday we were messaging as to whether or not we were going to focus on just the one story or the whole book. And we said, you know, we're just going to make mention in passing of the whole book. But I read the whole thing, obviously. And I thought it was pretty cool the way the stories are kind of independent stories within the book, but also are interconnected in a lot of ways as well. So I just thought that was, you know, was well handled.
Yeah, Byrne plotted at least all of the stories after that for the rest of the book. There was a Lois Lane story, which real quick, I got to talk about this. I like the Lois Lane story because she finds out, you know, the paparazzi caught Superman and Wonder Woman flying around, and they thought the news is that they're a couple, and you see Lois kind of break down for a minute. And then she talks to Clark and kind of confides in Clark, and then Clark has to go away because Jimmy's signal watch is going off. But I kind of, in a reread, I feel like this is almost the moment where, for this era of Superman, they sort of pivot from Lois being obsessed with Superman to putting her down that path where she and Clark eventually get engaged, which happened before she knew he was Superman. You know, I could feel like this is kind of where it started. And then after that, we get a Lex Luthor story, Jimmy Olsen, and then the weirdest one of all is a Man-Bat story at the end. But they all connect to each other. They all go one into each other, into another. And even the Man-Bat story ends with a setup for the next issue of Superman, which I think was issue 17. It dovetails into that because Byrne was finishing up his run. He only had a couple of issues of Superman left either after this was over, so he was kind of leading towards the end. It feels like a nice anniversary issue, and it works very well for me.
Yeah, the, you know, as far as the other issues go, or the other stories go, rather, I thought they were all entertaining. You know, not quite as on the level of the first story, but they were all entertaining in their own way. You were going to say?
No, I was agreeing. Yeah, you're right.
The Man-Bat story was interesting because of the artwork more than anything else for me. Mike Mignola is not an artist who I've followed very much. His style definitely lends itself to darker noir type stories, so you know, to put him on a Man-Bat one made sense. On the other hand, to have him on Superman, little different. But it's a Superman who's, you know, racked with fever and dealing with, you know, all sorts of stuff.
So, kryptonite poisoning, yeah.
Yeah, so it was just an interesting contrast in styles, especially when you compare it to the Byrne-Perez combination. Right.
And what's really funny is the story that this leads into, which, again, I think is Superman 17, Mignola drew that too. And that's one where Hawkman kind of takes Superman to the remnants of Krypton, which is just at this point is just a giant ball of kryptonite floating out there in space. And he has all these weird, bizarre visions. And again, you don't think of Mignola as being a Superman artist, but it fit that story really well.
I may have to check that out. I don't have any memory of reading that one. yet another story, much like in the first one, where it's got me intrigued enough to want to see more.
Absolutely.
I always think that's a sign of quality. I'm just looking at the artwork overall. Again, the first one, it's almost like the stories after the first one suffer from having the first one be so good.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. And I think a lot of it is some of the other stories are very much set up. You know, the other ones, the first story is very complete. It's all in and of itself. The other ones are all setting things up. The Lois thing is kind of setting up that relationship. The Lex Luthor thing has the revelation that the kryptonite ring he's been wearing has started to make him sick, which would become a major plot point later on. The Jimmy story is really just there to get us to the Man-Bat story. And then the Man-Bat story takes us into the next issue of Superman. So
I'm going to give the Jimmy story just slightly more credit than that, because I'm going to say not only does it take us to the Man-Bat story, but it also shows a Jimmy who isn't, he isn't Jack Larson from The Adventures of Superman. He's a Jimmy who's willing to step up and do whatever he has to help Superman, and you know, to man up when he has to, and take care of business a little bit. You know, he's willing to put himself into the line of danger to protect his friend, the same, you know, mm-hmm. not just be the helpless victim.
No, I agree. Look,
I like the personality that they're showing for Jimmy, as opposed to, like I said, just an annoying kid.
I love
The Adventures of Superman, but boy, you know, for a grown man that they had playing him, they had him talking like a 12-year-old through most of it.
Yeah, it's a much more capable Jimmy here than I think a lot of people think of when they think of Jimmy Olsen. I agree with you there.
And for what it's worth, the issue also, like in between each story, has a like a poster image by Barry.
Yeah, some very nice pinups in there. There's a John Bogdanov in there, and this is before he started drawing, you know, the Superman books regularly. And I love his. He's one of my favorite Superman artists. It was nice to see this early work of his in there too.
They have is that Mike Zeck, the one?
Yeah, there's a Zeck in there, I think.
That doesn't live up to the level I usually expect from Zeck, to be honest with you. That I, you know, he's got, Superman's got like 90 ribs, the way he's drawn, and he's a little bulky, and his body's twisted in a very strange way. So, mm-hmm. not usually I think more highly of Zeck than that.
Yeah.
But other than that, I'm very happy with this issue in general. Yeah. So I think this is a good choice, and I'm glad you got me to read it.
No, I'm glad I did too.
You want to do ratings on it?
Yeah, let's do it. And again, I kind of focused on the first story, so I'm going to do the ratings just for the first story. The cover, I love, like I said, I love the layout of the cover. I love this classic, very Silver Age anniversary style cover, and I love any time that they bring that back. So that automatically gets it several points for me. It's a little weird because the panels to the sides of the Superman statue, each one of them is a panel lifted from the story, except for the Superman and Wonder Woman panel, which I think was like the original cover for this issue before they decided to go for the anniversary thing. So it's a little jarring in that they don't all necessarily look like they go together. So for the cover, I'm gonna give it a B+ for the cover. Interior art, like we said, that Byrne and Perez combination is so good, and I love the fight scene so much. The faces are so expressive. That's a very easy A for me. Story again, I feel very effusive here, but I picked this because I love this issue. So this sort of embryonic form of the Superman and Wonder Woman friendship is something I like a lot, and that's an A. And really, you know, it's just a law of averages here. The book's an A overall for me. The first story, at least. The only thing that would even take it off a little, even in the other stories, is the other stories aren't as good. None of them are bad.
Yeah, we're pretty close on this one. I like the cover, and I like that it's evocative of, you know, the 80-page giants, or you know, whatever, you know, annuals came out, or all of that stuff. I think that is very cool, and I think it would make it something that you'd want to pick up. It was $2.50 as the cover price on it, and I'm trying to think, in 1988, that was probably, the average comic was probably a dollar back then, so you are paying for what you get.
And I think the Superman books were the last ones to go to a dollar. They were 75 cents for a few years into the 90s, so it was okay. A little bit cheaper than that, so you were really getting your money's worth here.
Yeah, and I think the panels they chose to put in are fine. So I think, you know, they blend well enough. I think the only thing I might have considered changing, and I would have to see how it would look, is each of the panels has kind of a square white background on it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if I might have changed the background on each one just to make it a little, see if it made it pop a little more. But other than that, I wouldn't change anything. I'm going to say a solid B+ on the cover. The mm-hmm. interior art, again, on the first story, it's Byrne and it's Perez. And there's points where you can see almost a contrast in this style, but for the most part, they blend really well. So I'm going to say an A on the art. And the story, it's excellent. The story is an A. It really, you know, it presents Darkseid well. And you know, when he has nothing to gain, he just leaves, which I think is kind of cool. So overall, I'd say the story's an A also, and the book is an A, and I'm glad you got me to read it, like I said. And the intertwining other stories, as you said, the worst complaint you can make about them is that they're not quite as good as the first one, but other than that, they're really good. So, and again, it leaves me wanting to see more, which is always a plus. So
absolutely.
Overall, an A book.
Mm-hmm.
So that's going to do it. Blake, you want to just give your blog information if people want to check it out?
Absolutely, yeah. Like I said, The Year of Superman, it's on my blog, which is blakempt.com. That's B-L-A-K-E-M-P-E-T-I-T. A new Year of Superman goes up every Wednesday. I also have another more general pop culture thing. I call it Geek Punditry that I do every Friday, and that's just about anything that comes to mind that I feel like talking about. Sometimes it's comics, sometimes it's movies, TV shows, just something in the world of pop culture. It's a lot easier to do the writing than the recording with a 7-year-old in the house. So I do that to keep my voice out there. So, and again, it's that Year of Superman. There's an archive going back to January. More stuff coming up. I'm so looking forward to the movie. I've got my tickets already. I can't wait to bring my son to sit there and watch a new Superman movie with me. I can't wait for that, and I'm sure I'm going to have so much to say in the blog when that happens. Other things, I've got, like I said, I've done some theme weeks. I've got some more coming up. I don't know exactly when they are going to happen, but I've got a week plan where I'll be doing Lex Luthor stories. I will be doing a week where I do Superman parodies, like from Mad Magazine or Marvel's What The, if you remember that, John Byrne actually did a Superman Fantastic Four parody in that book. That I'm going to be reading for the blog and other stuff like that throughout the rest of the year.
Very cool. Very cool. And it's very cool to get a chance to talk to you again. We don't talk.
Absolutely.
About my friend. I really appreciate you making the time, and hopefully, you know, I'm going to see if maybe, you know, I know, you know, you get, once September comes, you get busier. So maybe we could try and squeeze another one in before the school year starts.
I would love that. Yeah. If we could sometime in July. Yeah. Let me know.
I'll reach out to you after the recording, and we'll figure out a time that will.
No problem.
But thanks for coming on, and thank you everybody for listening, and we'll catch you next time.
Bye-bye. Thank you very much. Bye.
Thank you so much for listening to our show, and we hope you'll continue to join us each and every week for more good old-fashioned comic book back issue awesomeness. You can contact Back to the Bins to leave feedback, comments, questions, suggestions, and criticisms via email at bins@twotruefreaks.com or by joining the Back to the Bins group on Facebook. Back to the Bins is a proud affiliate of the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network, which you may find at www.twotruefreaks.com. Two True Freaks is a registered trademark of DiManzo Corp of Milan, Italy. All rights reserved. Please take a moment to stop by the twotruefreaks.com site and check out their many other fine podcasts, won't you? Thanks, and we'll see you next week.